It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on KSLpodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Today on the show, we had Sydney Dixon. She has been serving as a Utah State Superintendent of Public Education since June of 2016. She has worked in counseling, teaching, and leadership capacities in the Davis, Granite, and Murray school districts for decades. She holds a doctoral degree in education leadership and policy from the University of Utah and a master's of education degree from Brigham Young University in educational leadership and administration. Her bachelor's degree in elementary education and teaching is from Utah State University. Go Aggies. We had a great discussion. Let's get proximate. Welcome back to First Lady and Friends podcast. We are here with a very special episode. Our guest today is Sid Dixon. She has been the Utah State Superintendent of Public Instruction since June of 2016. I could go on and on. We'll do more of her bio, but I'm going to let you, Sid, tell us a little bit about you. Thanks for being here.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me, First Lady Cox. I have been an educator I'm in my 41st year, so I've been at this a long time, and I'm a real proud rural gal. I was raised in Antimony, Utah, and I just am going to leave it at that because I want people to pull out their map and find it if they don't know where that is.
Look it up. It's beautiful. I've been there. My daughter actually just went to a youth conference there this summer.
Excellent.
So you know where, though, right?
I do know where now. Back in the day, which people my age like to say, there were about 100 people in our community. It was agrarian. We were all farmers and just helped each other out. And, we relied on one another. And going to Richfield or Panguitch was a very exciting event in our home.
That's right. And now they have this ranch there. That's where my daughters stay. They have an incredible, I can't remember what it's called, Rocking Our Ranch.
Rocking Our Ranch. Yes. Great place.
So it's a really cool place. So I want to get back into this about your background. Let's talk about, so you grew up in Antimony. Is that where your parents were from? Tell us a little bit
parents. Yes. Both of my parents were from there originally. And I come from good pioneer stock, and they settled in Wayne County and in Garfield County and Paiute County. And my parents both are graduates of Paiute High. I come from a family of five, and we moved to the metropolis of St. George when I was in fifth grade. And I remember thinking it was such a big place because I went to a two-room schoolhouse where my grandmother was my teacher. And there, I had a huge class in Antimony Elementary of seven kids. And my little brother, 2 years younger, was solo in his grade level. So then you come to this place where there are two schools and two fifth grade classes to choose from. And it just felt very big to me. Now, when I go to visit my parents and my family and our second home in St. George, I marvel at the growth. Yeah. And remember thinking when I was a child, hearing that the Latter-day Saint Temple, the St. George Temple, would be in the center of the community as predicted by Brigham Young. And we lived at the edge of town, and I just remember thinking that was ludicrous. And here that valley has just exploded, but it's so beautiful. And I'm so grateful to live in Utah and really proud to just have been born and raised in Utah. It's amazing. It's an amazing, beautiful place.
It is amazing. And Antimony is not that close to St. George. People forget there's this whole section in between Payson and St. George that people kind of forget about.
Right.
So, I love that. So what influenced you as you were growing up to go into education?
I was not focused on education. In fact, I come from a family of very smart people, very hardworking, smart people who were not college oriented. My parents didn't go to college, so I didn't really have that push of that vernacular in my home. People didn't talk about their college experience, but it's something I knew I wanted to do. And my parents were very supportive of me going there or going on to further my education. So I thought I would graduate psychology or maybe English and go on to law school. I just knew that I wanted to make a difference. And I wanted to right the wrongs that I saw and stand up for the underdog. That was kind of the core of who I was as a kid and a teenager. So I thought law would be the way to do that. And I went up to Utah State after spending 2 years at Dixie. And
so Aggies?
To go Aggies, for sure. And took an education class. And just the minute a little kid sat on my lap and said, "Will you read me a story?" I was hooked. And I just kind of knew from that moment, watching the magic and the science and the art that goes into teaching, it was just so inspiring to me. And I knew it really was the way to make a difference. Education changes the world. So that's sort of my backstory of how I entered into teaching.
Did you have somebody that influenced you to do that? I mean, sometimes we go through and we have teachers. I mean, obviously you had not as many teachers maybe as some of us because of the small rural area you were in. But was there someone along the way that really maybe inspired you in that way?
I think my grandmother, who was my teacher for several years, she was inspirational to me. She would create magic out of every little thing. And now there's research to back up all of the things that she used to do with us. I remember asking her, she lived to be 103, so I got to spend a lot of time with her. And I would ask her, Grandma, how did you learn how to teach kids to read? Back then, I think she went to like a 2-year teacher college program, and she didn't even have to do that until she was older. But she just did so many things intuitively that really are backed by research today. So I think she instilled that love of teaching in me. She had 65 grandchildren, 11 children and 65 grandchildren.
Wow.
And there are many teachers in our family, and I know it was from her influence. She was fun and joyful and positive. And part of our learning was what we would call life skills. We would call social-emotional learning. We had community circle. She taught us how to knit and crochet. So there are like just a lot of really interesting things that I learned in her classroom. And then moving forward, I think I had a couple of teachers who tapped me and said, "You're not living up to your potential. You can do more.
Okay.
You know, you're smarter than you're giving yourself credit for. Redo this work and do it well." And I had Mrs. Blackham, who was a business and I don't know what her call would have been then, business and marketing teacher, I guess. And she was very professional and really taught us to be polished and do our best. So I've had some teachers along the way that I think brought out the good in me, and I saw the influence they had in helping me shape my image of self.
That's really interesting because, obviously I grew up in a rural area too, and I had similar experience in that people around me, education wasn't, not in my family, but the community, that people, education was not a priority. And in a lot of ways still isn't in rural areas. So I think it's beautiful that you picked up on that. Do you see a difference between rural and urban areas when it comes to education?
That's a great question. And I have had the opportunity to travel to all 41 of our districts and many charter schools over the last 4 or 5 years. Of course, during the pandemic, I didn't get out to as many schools. But I have noticed in our rural areas that they are extremely innovative. You know, they have to be. They don't have the opportunities that a lot of our kiddos have in urban and suburban spaces to be hands-on. So bringing digital tools into schools, being able to take advanced courses, including concurrent enrollment, has been great for our rural communities. So they're investing really wisely in technology and opportunities for our students. And I really do see a lot of innovative practices and great caring cultures in schools. You walk into a rural school and the climate has its own unique sense of kids really being part of the culture of the school and that their voice is included, and they have a lot of opportunities because there are fewer students. So every teacher in a rural school is a coach or an advisor. So I think the adults in our rural schools are hyper-involved, meaning that they do they are busy well beyond the classroom, almost every teacher. So it's more of a community approach to education, where in our urban and suburban settings, they're also doing great things, but it's more isolated sometimes to the school and not so much out into the community.
Yeah, I can see that a lot. I'm just now beginning to experience an urban environment for education with my daughter, because we've been in a rural district all these years, and now my daughter's here in Salt Lake. And the thing that has struck me is very, I don't know, it's interesting. I'm not sure if it's good or bad, but I haven't decided yet. But there's a sense of community in rural schools because, I mean, like, my daughter's been friends with her same group of friends since she was in preschool. And they, you know, it's my neighborhood. It's my, you know, the friends I go to church with. It's all these, and then they move on together. And so then they're in high school together, and it's her uncle that's the counselor, and it's her cousins that she goes to school with. And you see this in rural areas. And then in urban areas, you know, you go to your congregation here in Salt Lake, and maybe one of the kids goes to your same school, but, you know, they all go to different schools. And I don't know, do you think that helps or hurts that sense of community? What do you think about that?
Well, I just think it's different. Context matters. If you're in an urban or suburban setting, you might have more choice than you would in a rural setting for where you go to school. In a rural setting, it's a sense of community. And in that, as you just mentioned, the school blends out into the community and vice versa. It's sort of the center or the hub of the community, where schools in an urban and suburban setting, they are they're in the community, but there are blurred boundaries. So you have kids from all over the valley who might be attending a school. Well, I mean, there are boundaries drawn, but they are permeable. So there is a blend of students. And it's, I mean, in some ways it's good, you know, in that kids can mix from a variety of neighborhoods and have different experiences. It's more challenging in that sometimes those relationships can be fleeting or only at the school setting. So I don't know that I would establish a value to it. It's just different.
That's amazing. I'm glad you said that. It is, I think, I always say there are trade-offs when people ask me, you know, coming from rural and coming here, you know, my boys were involved in so many different things. Whereas, you know, coming up to Salt Lake, I'm thinking, okay, where can Emma Kate, where can my daughter sort of fit? Where can she find her niche? And so, I mean, I think it's really important that we sort of build that sense of community around our children and make sure that they feel that. So I so appreciate this conversation. And I want to continue it and talk a little bit more about your education journey, and we'll be right back.
Two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent, it was senseless, and I will never understand it, I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back here with Sid Dixon. She is the superintendent of public instruction here in the state of Utah, and just amazing, and also a dear friend. We've gotten to know each other, and you've been a mentor to me, so I so appreciate anytime I'm with you. I feel like I'm learning something and learning how to be better in education. So we so appreciate you being here. Let's talk a little bit about maybe what makes Utah unique in education.
I think the symbol of the beehive is so apropos, and I don't know if it's just since we established ourselves as a state, it's always been this way. But we tend to work together on behalf of a cause, whatever that cause is. And education is one of those that I think people are genuinely invested in our state. So we, you know, we may not be rank high on the funding list,
right?
But we definitely rank high on interest and parent involvement. I think that we can always do a better job of making sure our educators feel honored. But by and large, we're an educated state, and we're one where people pitch in and they're willing to help and do whatever. If somebody says we need shoes for kiddos at our school, somebody's always willing to make that happen or fill backpacks or make sure kids are fed. You know, during the pandemic, I can't tell you how many people called our office saying, we want to make sure kids don't go hungry. How do we go about making sure that they're fed? So people genuinely care about kids. And we have a lot of them.
Yeah.
So that definitely makes us unique for sure.
Yeah. I think people would be interested to know the structure of Utah's education system here in the state. And it's different than I think people realize. The governor gets a lot of attention, and I would say in a lot of ways, a lot of blame when it comes to the education system in the state. But tell us a little bit about why maybe that isn't as fair as it maybe should be.
Well, every state has a different structure. You're absolutely right. And we have a structure that is, there are a lot of hands on the wheel when it comes to education. But the governance structure is local first, which is where it should be. So schools are governed by locally elected nonpartisan school boards, and they select their superintendent, and the superintendent hires principals, etc. So it's very locally driven. At the state level, we have a now partisan elected school board. That's just happened recently due to a court case. So it's partisan elections, 15-member board, and they have governance over rules and policies. General control and supervision is the way that it's laid out in the state constitution. And the 15-member elected board appoint me as their state official. The legislature has a role in that they also provide policy from a legislative standpoint, and they determine the funding for our state. So they play a very significant role. The governor has a platform and can influence policy and funding, but has this ancillary role. And I'm grateful to your husband, our good governor, who truly walks the talk when it comes to education. He has been invested as a lieutenant governor, but he does use his platform to show up and to really push forward policy that benefits schools. So we all work in concert together. Our hands are all on the wheel, but we do have sort of this trickle down of policy. And I hope both a bottom up and a top down when it comes to innovation and support and practice. But things happen locally. So parents, for example, when they want to solve a problem, it should be teacher first, then principal, district, et cetera. And I'm sure, as you mentioned, sometimes a frustrated parent might call the governor directly. I know they call our office directly wanting that solved. But we do have this good structure. And in some states, it's different. You know, the governor has a different role over education, but our constitution lays it out in a certain way. And governance is always a topic of conversation on the Hill. I'm sure it will be again next year as people try to figure out who really is driving the bus when it comes to state education and where is everybody's role in that space.
Yeah, and I think, you know, just like everything else, the states are the, you know, the laboratory of democracy and laboratory of education and how we want to do things. And do you find some, you know, networking successes with other states and other superintendents of states?
Absolutely. I belong to the Council of Chief State School Officers, CCSSO in short. I am a member of their board, and it is an organization that is just made up of state chiefs, including our territories. So, you know, you think of the Virgin Islands and Guam and Puerto Rico, and we all work together and we discuss our problems and solution and different policy streams and provide resources and tools. And it's a lifeline for many of us. You know, when we were going through this past year, just being able to turn to my peers and ask them how they were dealing with certain situations, or have somebody call me and say, where did you get all of your technology? You know, how come you're ahead? What's your plan? And to be able to help and share and support each other has been phenomenal. And it's not just for chiefs. You know, there are deputies and other employees at the state agency that also have networks with their peers across the country. And it's very helpful to share and to learn from each other. And we're doing many things in Utah that people are looking to and asking about as well.
Yeah, I think we've been pretty, I mean, even in our little rural district, I mean, the technology, I feel like we're pretty far ahead as far as that goes, which is, you know, pretty amazing. I know that's not always the case.
Right.
Everywhere, but it's important to point that out. What are some other maybe things that you're proud of that you've accomplished here in the state, or that we have as educators or as an education community?
For me, it's always a we. I can't think of anything I've done alone. I just surround myself with amazing people and try to hold up examples of great things that are happening out in our schools. I'm really proud of our digital teaching and learning work. I think we were able to pivot very quickly. I know pivot's an overused word with the pandemic, but I would say we had moderate success based on what I've heard from other states in being able to get tools in the hands of kids and get them home in that March of 2020 when everything closed down. Last year, we had some blended models. We had some families learning only online. And we learned a lot of lessons along the way, but our teachers have engaged in professional learning, so they're better equipped. But we at least had about 70% of our students who had tools. And then we've had a lot of great innovation around developing networks. Murray and San Juan District have both received national attention for some of the things they did. I'm really proud of our dual immersion program. Yeah. I think we're a lighthouse to the nation in the way that so many of our students are able to engage in learning a second and sometimes a third language and can graduate from high school with an associate's in a language. So I'm very proud of the investment that we've made there. I'm proud of the collaborative efforts with business and with health. I think we're doing some great things in those spaces. And then we've launched Portrait of a Graduate, which for us has truly the map that we're following, having kids master certain content, including digital literacy and financial literacy, becoming autonomous learners, engaging in creative thinking and problem solving and collaboration and communication, and then finding purpose in life and in school and engaging in service and developing empathy. So that map puts our kids on the road to awesome.
Wow, that's amazing. And you and I have talked a little bit about this Portrait of Graduate, and it's what kind of gets me excited. It's you know, part of, you know, our initiative. We want to help push that as well. And so talk a little bit about how that came about. I know we've had pushes from companies and organizations that are saying, you know, what we need is better prepared humans for the world that they're going to face. Talk a little bit about how this Portrait of a Graduate came to be.
Sure. Our board established a strategic plan, which I personally have been so grateful for, because it kind of keeps you moving forward and you know where you're going. You know what the goals are. And we hold ourselves accountable for that plan. And the four goals that we were focused on, or four areas of focus, I should say, are early childhood learning, effective teachers and leaders in every classroom, safe and healthy schools, and then personalized learning. And we leaned into personalized learning, not just focused on technology, but thinking about how do we develop a system that truly is a personal experience for each student based on their needs. So we were also looking at trying to move away from some of the things like seat time. I call them the three Bs, bells, buses, and butt time. You might scrap that seat time. bottom time. And those, you know, that's driven a lot of the way we do schooling. So getting away from that and making time a variable instead of a constant, and thinking more about competencies, that trying to create a more personalized approach really led us to Portrait of a Graduate and the development thereof. And it's been done by teachers. We've had community input, input from certainly our business community, and a lot of survey work and just a couple of years of input to develop what we have now. And we have teachers who came together during the pandemic digitally to develop competencies. So it's really an organic, aspirational document that we want other districts and charters to take and say, what is our portrait of a graduate? What does it look like in our setting?
I love that. I think education is always better when we adapt it to our, you know, unique situations. And so I think that's beautiful that this can be a framework that other districts and everyone can use. I want to continue this conversation and talk. You mentioned a little bit about teachers and a little bit about this COVID year. I want to keep going there. We'll be right back. Welcome back. We want to continue our conversation with Sid Dixon, our state superintendent of public instruction. I have to go back up and read say the whole title. Let's talk about our teachers. We've had some experiences, and we've talked about this on the podcast, meeting with teachers, talking to teachers, mostly listening to teachers tell us about this year. I've had personal experiences with my kids' teachers reaching out to me and saying, this is literally the hardest year in my entire career. You talked about pivoting a little bit earlier, and let's talk a little bit about what you've seen teachers do this year.
Well, I think, you know, there were two phases. So the first phase was closing schools down in March. And, you know, first we thought it might be 2 weeks and then maybe another week. And that news to them that you're not going to see your kids in person again through the end of the year, that was hard, and it was a point of having to grieve the rituals of the end of the year, and that was a hard loss, I think, for not only our students but our teachers. So coming into the fall, they were anticipating what will it look like. You know, I think they did a lot in the summer trying to get ready, and then the year of masks and distancing and hygiene, so much of their energy was put in trying to keep kids healthy.
And themselves,
right? Yeah. And so there was this thread of fear, I think, just fear and the unknowing and yet trying to do all the great things that they do. And their lesson plans had to change. They had kids at home. They had hybrid models going. They had face-to-face. And let's not forget that most of our teachers are parents. Yeah. And so they're dealing with all of their issues at home as well. So they had all of these factors that were just heavy, and it was hard, and they rocked it. I mean, they did their very best, and I'm amazed at the work that they did. And I think for me, some of the silver linings are the things that they learned that they wanted to change, things that maybe they'd been doing that weren't as important. I loved how important relationships became. They've always known that intuitively, but it became even more apparent, and all the individual attention that they were giving to each student and to each family. And the things I saw them do going above and beyond were just so incredibly inspiring. So I was so happy for them to have a little bit of a break this summer. Yeah. But, you know, typical of our teachers, they rested for a nanosecond, and then they were right back to planning and engaging in professional learning and being together. And I had the opportunity to be with teachers over the summer, and they just had energy and enthusiasm and talking about what they'd learned and what they were going to do differently. So they just did an incredible job in by far the hardest year ever. And I think we did well.
Yeah.
I'm very proud of them. And I'm, even though we're facing some similar things this fall, I think they'll take those lessons learned and do even better.
You know, we've heard in the last little while that we have many hundreds of healthcare workers that left the profession, the stress and the chaos and the, you know, health issues that they had as a result of COVID and this last 18 months. We kind of anticipated that teachers, we might see the same thing in teachers. Have we?
We haven't seen the exodus that was predicted.
Yeah.
I think as I've talked to many of our education leaders, they're hiring about the same number that they've hired in the past. But times have changed from when I started my career. You know, we have teachers going into the profession not planning on teaching for 20 or 30 years. So we're in this different space where we're turning over more teachers than we did a decade or two decades ago anyway. And that's true across the country. So I think it's important for our teachers to get the kind of support that they need to make sure that they have the working conditions that are conducive for them to want to stay, because they really want to make a difference and they want to stay. But, you know, we need to make sure we pay our teachers well and provide conditions for them so that they really can do their best work. And that's, you know, that's on us as a state and a community to do that for them.
I agree. And I think most of us who are parents realize this year, I hope we appreciate the teachers in our lives more than we ever have before. I hope we did before, but I certainly am one of those that just was in awe at the heart that they taught with, that they worked with, that they, you know, I've told this story at a few of the events I've spoken at, but I had a teacher write my daughter a little note at the end of the year, just talking about how, you know, just really a note of encouragement after her tough year, you know? So it's just, you know, it's beautiful. The teachers, you know, obviously have a special place in my heart because my mom was an educator, my grandmother was an educator, and I myself was in special education. So I want to talk about special education and what are you seeing in that field right now? Are you through the pandemic, there are extra issues with, and this is what people forget about, our kids with all different abilities maybe even had more issues during the pandemic than people realize.
Well, it goes back to the personalization of services. And for our students with disabilities, that has always been the case, that they need specialized services. And it's providing them with what they need to make sure that they can access the content and what they need. So part of the challenges during the pandemic, especially again the spring of 2020, but even going further, some of our kiddos who are medically fragile and need additional services and not being able to get to school and not being able to have those services in their home, occupational therapy, physical therapy, a lot of those support systems were suddenly absent in that child's life. And it sets some of our kids back from where they were making progress. That's a reality. So, you know, digital tools help a lot. And sometimes that is actually a strategy for some of our students with disabilities, having some adaptive technology. But it also made it very hard when what a lot of our students with disabilities need, especially those who have disabilities that are a little bit more, or different abilities that are a little bit more severe, and they need a lot of services, it was a challenge. And I think that our families know that well. Yeah. And we'll be trying to make that up. But, you know, there are just some things that you have to say we'll do the best we can with where the child is at moving forward. And so I know that it's all hands on deck for our students with disabilities, for sure. And providing there's an acronym of MSST, or multi systems of support. Yeah. So we hear about those multi-tiered systems of support a lot. And it's such an important way to approach educating all students, but especially students with disabilities. So they should get what they need in the regular classroom so that they can be with their peers. But sometimes students need a little extra layer of support and then some intense support. And that intense support was lacking during the pandemic for many of our students.
Yeah, I remember as a, you know, a student teaching, I remember being in the classroom all day with my kiddos. And some of them had pretty severe disabilities. A lot of them, you know, had, you know, were not mobile. A lot of them were nonverbal, and just tough. I mean, it's tough. they're beautiful and they're wonderful. But I do remember thinking about those parents. And, you know, I was exhausted and I would send this kid home each day after school thinking, well, I can go home and rest. But that parent, you know, that's a day in and day out. So I can imagine during the pandemic, if you've got this child home and the amount of stress, the extra stress, we were all stressed in our own ways. But that just seems to have added a completely huge burden on some of these families.
Right.
Sid, this has been such a pleasure for me. I guess I just want to end with asking this. What do you wish people knew about Utah education?
Well, I think people do know this, so I don't know that it's a wish, but I wish that we would understand that education takes all of us, that it's all in, and it doesn't matter what state you live in. So if we – I'll go back to where I started. If we are the beehive state and we're busy and we're buzzing about and working together in the hive, then it should be that we're all in focused on what each individual student needs. And whether that's just those basic needs of food and shelter and clothing, or it's making sure that our students, regardless of demographics, have access to rigor and to challenging coursework and opportunities for internships and prepared pathways to be successful in the world of work or going on to higher education, that we collectively as a community, whether we have students in the system or not, we play a part in that. And if we want to continue to have a thriving economy, then we all have to support public education. It's critical to the success of our state.
Yeah, absolutely. That's as upstream as it gets. So we take care of our kids here in the state. Thank you, Sid. This has been such a pleasure for me to again learn more from you. We're so appreciative of all the work that you're doing in the state and for our kiddos in the state. And we so appreciate the mentorship that you've provided me. So thank you for being here today.
Well, thank you, First Lady, for being so dedicated and devoted to our kiddos and to public education. We really appreciate it.
You can find Sid Dixon on Twitter at Dixon Sid and also at UT Public Ed. Thanks for being a friend.